The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, my notes tell me that we may have Manitowoc Lincoln High School students here. If they are here, would they stand, please? Oh, very nice. Very nice. You may be seated. Well, we like to have you come to court. We hope we'll get a couple of lawyers out of you by the time you get done. You'll be interested in what these folks are going to do here. The students are here in a program we operate in coordination with the State Bar called Court with Class. So they've heard a little bit about the case that you're going to argue. If you all can stay after this argument, and anybody else who chooses to also, Justice Rebecca Bradley, who sits down at the end of the bench there, will come down and chat with you a little bit about procedures in the Supreme Court and how it is that cases arrive here for us to decide. So with those preliminaries, I will call our next case, OLR versus James Schoenecker. Are you prepared to proceed?
We are.
Please do.
Please the court. My name is Richard Kao. I'm here with my colleague, Stacey Rosenzweig, on behalf of Attorney James Schoenecker. We have a mercifully simple set of issues to contend with today. Essentially, the court is acquainted with Mr. Schoenecker. He was suspended twice from the practice of law and applied for reinstatement January 2017. This most recent suspension was by this court in April of 2016 for a period of 1 year. And it was upon a stipulation with the OLR that that was a suitable period of suspension, suitable discipline under the circumstances. Upon applying for reinstatement, however, the OLR opposed the reinstatement and first conducted an investigation for a period of approximately 6 months. And in doing so, didn't uncover a shred of information suggesting inappropriate conduct by Mr. Schoenecker during the period of suspension or the period just preceding that, but nevertheless opposed the reinstatement proceeding solely on the basis of the information giving rise to the original disciplinary matters. And in fact, Mr. Schoenecker, at his reinstatement hearing, produced evidence from 13 different witnesses with information about his conduct during the period of suspension, the extent to which the suspension affected him, the improvements in his behavior and efforts to reform his character, and all of which supported reinstatement, in response to which the OLR produced three witnesses. Each of the witnesses were the victims in the original misconduct matters, and asked them to describe in lurid detail the extent to which they suffered, the facts that they were involved in the wrongdoing that the court had previously analyzed, ask them whether they thought Mr. Schoenecker should be reinstated, whether he had the moral character to resume practice of law, and not surprisingly, those victims said, no, we think he shouldn't be reinstated, and that would come as little surprise. Importantly, none of those witnesses, nor any of the information submitted by the OLR in this case, involved facts that postdated the order of this court imposing a one-year suspension. So a couple things. Number one, we recognize that the conduct giving rise to the first and second suspension was serious wrongdoing. We're not trying to minimize that. But the OLR understood that as well when they stipulated to that period of suspension. The court understood it when they imposed the periods of suspension at issue here.
Do you know, counsel, one of the factors that seems to play a big part in reading both OLR's briefs, well, especially in OLR briefs, is the remorse or more specifically lack of remorse of your client. And I think one of the things that is, from what I can read, from what I can understand from reading the briefs of OLR, is they're making the argument that the witnesses that they called during the proceedings testified that there was no expression made by your client to them of remorse for his conduct. Can you comment on
that? The most poignant of those witnesses was his ex-fiancée, and her testimony was, I think, very moving to the referee. But Mr. Scheneker did say, "I'm sorry." I don't know that he said it in a way that resonated with the attorneys for the OLR. But bear in mind, he was in the aftermath of the events giving rise to his criminal prosecution, was subject to a no-contact order with this person. So he couldn't very well approach her and say, "I'm sorry." I think he made expressions of being sorry in his own way on a number of occasions. I understand that I guess I would urge the court to recognize what a dangerous standard that is, to say we want an expression of remorse in a dramatic fashion or a fashion that suits the sensibilities of the OLR. I mean, he certainly testified that he was sorry. He testified that it had a terrible effect on the victims. It had a terrible effect on him and his family. He took very concrete steps to reform his conduct. He broke down in tears during the testimony. The OLR can characterize it as it will. But also bear in mind, the opposition to this reinstatement was right from the outset, without benefit of any of the testimony at the hearing.
This question,
Hale,
this question, my line of questioning is not a surprise to you, because you were asked virtually the same question at the tail end of the, I think it was Judge Moore who presided.
Yes.
And you asked your client, I think one of your last questions to him is, "Look, they're not satisfied that you're sorry. Is there anything you want to say?"
Right.
I mean, virtually holding up a billboard saying, you know, "Do you want to say you're sorry?"
Yes.
And he still, I read that, I read this last week, early last week, and so my memory isn't crystal clear on it. But even then, his response was cloudy, shall we say. It was a little self-focused. It was a little, "Gee, I suffered terribly, and I wouldn't do it again because it had bad effects on me." It doesn't seem to me that OLR is harping on the idea that he won't say "I'm sorry" so much as they're concerned that there seems to be something missing here. There seems to be some sort of empathy or some sort of peace missing that might lead to a reoffend because of his failure to empathize with his victims. That's really the issue as far as I could narrow it down.
Right, and I understand that. And I think the OLR and the court is properly concerned with the extent to which someone is personally resolved to refrain from behavior like that for the right reasons. Mr. Scheneker is here today. He is sorry. I mean, and the fact that he may not express it in a way that is sort of as dramatically effective as it might otherwise be under circumstances like those presenting themselves at the hearing shouldn't be a bar to giving him a chance to resume a productive place in the world.
So, counsel, let's consider this. You mentioned
Justice Kelly, could I interrupt you just a second?
Yes.
Justice Abrahamson started out the
same time
Justice Gableman did, and I asked her to wait. So let me ask her. Justice Abrahamson?
Then
I'll get back to you in a minute.
Mr. Kale, you have the burden of proof to show that Mr. Scheneker has the character needed to be reinstated as a lawyer. And what evidence is in the record that you have carried that burden?
Thank you. Yes, we have the testimony of Mr. Scheneker, but we also have admitted into evidence character references from 13 different individuals, three of whom testified live at the hearing, and 10 of which whose opinions were admitted into evidence by stipulation, weren't even referred to by the referee. Each of these people were acquainted with Mr. Scheneker for a collective period of 250 years. Each of them had evidence of experiences with him during the period, the relevant period, the period between his last suspension and the time of the hearing.
Except
all of them said that he had reformed his conduct, that he had tried to improve himself.
Mr. Cale, the briefs indicate that many of these witnesses had no idea that he had been suspended, didn't know what his alleged conduct was, and that...
I don't believe that's true. I believe that his father testified that he was ill acquainted with some of the underlying problems.
Okay.
But I believe for the most part, the witnesses whose opinions were submitted on paper by stipulation were well acquainted. In fact, many of them were letters solicited by the OLR because these were people identified as references in connection with the reinstatement questionnaire. Moreover, Mr. Scheneker recognized, and I think it's refreshing for him to have recognized, the relationship between an underlying gambling pathology and his wrongdoing. He didn't blame his wrongdoing entirely on gambling, but his life was on a very enviable arc before he got introduced to casino gambling at Pottawatomie. He graduated high in his class from Columbia Law School, worked for Hughes, Hubbard, and Reed, wanted to move back to Milwaukee to be close to his family, and whereupon he took the bar, passed it, and was scooped up by Quarles and Brady, and at the same time began gambling at Pottawatomie. Testified that he spent hours and hours there every day. And so he recognized, and prior to that, I don't think he was accused of a lick of wrongdoing. Or since, frankly, the OLR's investigation didn't turn up so much as a parking ticket. And after suffering the events giving rise to the last suspension, before the last suspension, he self-banned himself from the Pottawatomie Casino. He undertook counseling with a psychologist who specializes in gambling addictions, Mr. Harrison.
How do you self?
I don't know exactly, but you go to Pottawatomie and say, because they bear a responsibility. They recognize that addiction, that pathology. And so you can go to them and say, do not let me in the casino. And by his description, by Mr. Scheneker's description, if he did show up there, they'd drag him off in handcuffs. So there is a means of doing that. I'm not clear on the precise mechanism, but I am aware that one can do that. And
Counsel,
he has abstained from gambling. He's attended Gamblers Anonymous meetings.
Okay.
Counsel, could I...
He was suspended for a year in April 2016, is
correct.
That right? And the conduct was from when to when?
The original conduct was from 2008 and 2009.
Mm-hmm.
The conduct in relation to that 2016 suspension, I believe, was up until the preceding year, 2015, when this business that he was involved in expelled him.
Justice Kelly, I think, has a question for you.
Counsel, you mentioned your concern that the OLR was not relying on information that succeeded the latest suspension. So I want to concentrate on that a little bit. My understanding is that Mr. Scheneker began counseling with Mr. Harrison subsequent to that suspension. Is that correct?
Subsequent to the first suspension, yes.
Okay. And I believe in your briefs you called Scheneker 2 a wake-up call. Is that right? I believe
yes.
That's on page 7, and that he realized he had real problems that needed to be addressed. And to that end, he began treating with Mr. Harrison.
Yes, that is in response to the underlying events, not the imposition of the discipline.
So Mr. Harrison reports that Mr. Scheneker told him that his strengths were, quote, loyalty, honesty, and trustworthiness.
Yes.
Right? And I think it's quite apparent that that is not true.
Well, I disagree with you, Justice Kelly.
All right, let me just set the table for you so that you can have something to work against. So he cheated his fiancée.
Yes.
He cheated his business partner.
I don't believe he cheated his business partner. He made use of the company money without pre-authorization, but they were never deprived of any of the funds to which they were entitled. So cheated is, I think, an overstatement.
Okay. But he's misused.
He wasn't responsible in dealing with them.
Yeah.
Correct.
And so he's misused funds.
Yes.
Yeah? And he did not show himself loyal to his fiancée. Right?
No. No.
And did not show himself to be trustworthy to his fiancée. Right?
Correct.
Or honest.
Right.
So what are the factual bases for him saying that his strengths are loyalty, honesty, and trustworthiness?
I think that one can lead a generally honorable life and have steps out of character to that life that don't describe their general characteristics. And I think that to an extent when he was being asked by his counselor to describe himself, he was talking aspirationally, that he puts a value on honesty and loyalty and trustworthiness. I don't think he would.
I understand that's the argument, but what Mr. Harrison said was that he reported his strengths, not his desires, not his aspirations, but his strengths were those three characteristics.
And I think that can exist in juxtaposition to some anomalous steps out of bounds.
Okay, but you understand, of course, that what we're trying to figure out here is how Mr. Shenaker is going to behave if he is admitted back to the practice
yes.
of law.
Yes.
And that some of the most important characteristics we look for are evidence of loyalty, honesty, and trustworthiness.
Yes.
Right? And so when he reports those as his then-existing strengths to his counselor, that gives me some unease that he recognizes what that entails.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt he recognizes the inappropriateness of the conduct that got him into trouble, and that didn't reflect an adherence to those principles, to those characteristics. But I don't think he never got into any other kind of trouble before or since. And I think, in part, the evidence of his the extent to which he can be relied on to observe those characteristics or to reflect those characteristics is his behavior in the time since. And sometimes it's the absence of wrongdoing which suggests an honorable life. He's
Counselor,
reconnected.
Are there maintenance procedures for someone who has a gambling addiction as there are for someone who has an alcohol addiction? And if so, what are they?
Yes. One is attendance at Gamblers Anonymous meetings, which is a 12-step program, much like that that addicts and alcoholics make use of. And he is continuing to treat with Dr. Harrison, who is a psychologist who specializes in that. And then, like other kinds of addiction programs, it calls for absolute abstinence from gambling. Not moderate gambling, not reasonable gambling, but absolute abstinence, and he's maintained that. I think the OLR and the referee, they spoke in terms of a cure. What can you show us to show that you've been cured of these shortcomings? And I think that sets an unreasonable standard. I don't think anybody would suggest that pathologies of this kind are cured. Alcoholics don't get cured.
Like alcoholism, they always say person is always a recovering alcoholic, not a former alcoholic.
Right. And so I think there's neither a cure nor a guarantee. And I think if you were to impose a requirement on reinstatement applicants saying we want some sort of a guarantee that you're not going to victimize the public in the way you did previously, you wouldn't reinstate anyone.
What this conversation is reminding me of is my 6 years as a circuit court judge, and especially when I would prepare for the larger sentencings. And what I would tell the individual is that it's not my job to judge you as a person. It's my job to judge your conduct. And I am personally uncomfortable with any part of this conversation which devolves into a discussion of judging your client as a person. That's not my job. Right. And I am not going to sit. You know, one of the most interesting interviews I ever read was of the late Justice Pat Crooks. And this was after he had announced originally he wasn't going to run for re-election, but then he decided to run for re-election. And then he, in an interview he gave, he made an offhand comment that the reporter published or the editor published, and he said, you know, most people, all of us, I think he said, he didn't say most, all of us are a mixed bag. We all have our good and our bad. Now the question about his loyalty and his good points, I assume he's got a relationship with his father. His father came to testify on his behalf. I assume he didn't come to do so at gunpoint.
Correct.
Okay? So I infer that the man gets along in life and navigates life in general. Now, the question is, for me, and this is to put OLR on notice, I see the representative there, is, you know, why is this not continuing punishment for something he's already been suspended for? I'm one of seven. But that's what's on my mind. How much do we need someone to crawl before they've paid the price? How much do we need them to say, what are the magic words we need them to articulate? I'm not letting him off the hook. I don't think, I read the comments. I don't think he was a model of expression of remorse. Don't get me wrong. But for what it's worth, I'm not sitting here in judgment of him as a person.
But if I think I agree with that, and you did judge the offense. Knowing everything that you know now, this court judged the offense and said, we're imposing a one-year suspension. And that was a suspension that expired a year ago, roughly.
Counsel, but doesn't the law require us, our law, our Supreme Court Rule 22.31, require us to judge the person? The moral character, it states under sub 1, the petitioner has the burden of demonstrating by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence all of the following, A, B, C, and D. C and D are kind of cryptic. It's really A and B that we focus on. A, that he or she has the moral character, the person.
Right.
To practice law in Wisconsin, and then B is whether or not the resumption would be detrimental to the administration of justice, etc. So I see this case as, is there sufficient evidence in the record to say, as the referee did, that you failed to meet the burden of demonstrating by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence the moral character to practice law. So those are kind of difficult and unwieldy concepts.
Right. We can't look inside someone's head. We can only judge them by what they do. I don't even think we should judge them by what they say. If you tell me there's some magic words, I can make sure my client says them. If there's some magic conduct, I can make sure my client takes part in that before applying for reinstatement. But in this case, we had a host of witnesses who knew him. He took a job doing landscaping work, ascended into a position of some authority, was trusted with the company credit cards by a man who put into evidence his confidence that Mr. Scheniker would be trustworthy.
Do you agree with me that this is a sufficiency of evidence case?
Yes. And what I would suggest to you is that there is a host of, there is a wealth of evidence of reinstatement eligibility and not a shred of evidence to the contrary.
Maybe a little exaggeration for emphasis. I mean, you had the three witnesses of OLR that certainly impugned his integrity and addressed the moral character.
Right, except that none of them had seen him in any for a decade in one case, and any of them, none of them had any firsthand information about him in the period from the time you imposed a one-year suspension and the time of the reinstatement hearing. So that none of them, I mean, I understand that the cases say make relevant the original information just to set the table and to make, you know, the referee and the court appreciate the circumstance under which the reinstatement is being applied for. But the focus, you've pointed out in previous decisions, should be on the conduct during the interim. And with respect to that, his conduct was blameless. And I think, to an extent, it's the absence of bad conduct that shows a decent life.
Counsel,
can donate organs and blood and go join the Peace Corps as a means of demonstrating it, but really, I'm a good person if I don't behave badly.
Counsel, if I could turn you back to some of the predictive aspects of what we're supposed to be about today. You mentioned that, that Mr. Shenaker acknowledged the gambling issue, but also found that he suffered from situational anxiety, depression, and poor decision-making.
Yes.
I'd like to concentrate on that last, because you also put in your brief that he would continue to attend counseling and avoid situations that would trigger negative behavior.
Yes.
So let's put those two things together. What is the nature of the poor decision-making? How is that being addressed? And what situations are triggering bad decision-making?
I mean, I think the situations that might trigger it are to be involved in any kind of gambling or in a casino or any sort of milieu that stimulates that gambling addiction. The poor decision-making is that point at which, you know, one gets into trouble and maxes out their credit card with respect to the gambling at the casino and decides, I'll use the company credit card and repay it in the morning. That's poor decision-making, and I think Mr. Harrison has addressed that and pronounced a very favorable prognosis for Mr. Shenaker's abstinence from gambling in the future. And if this court were to say, we want you to continue seeing... I see my light on. I'm sorry.
Yes, do you want to just conclude quickly? You have rebuttal.
If you were to order him to continue treatment, I'm sure that he would do it. He's planning to do it in any case.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. It's a late morning, but morning nonetheless. I'm Bill Weigel. I'm representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation in this proceeding. This is really, a tale of two cities. A referee obviously functions as a trial judge.
It was the best of times and it was the worst of times?
It was the worst of times at some point regarding Mr. Shenaker's conduct earlier, and he has attempted to show his rehabilitation, and it is a matter of sufficiency of proof and not retrying and rehashing the old case. But your referee, Jim Moore of Hartford, acts as the eyes and ears of this court. He held a public hearing on July 18th of 2017. He heard all of the witnesses. He asked them questions. He received the 27 exhibits, all 27 of which were introduced by OLR. Referee Moore closely reviewed the court's standards, 2231, Mr. Shenaker's reinstatement proofs, and made the determination that the petitioner did not meet his burden of proof. The referee was troubled by the gravity and by the extent.
But didn't it seem, Mr. Weigel, that Judge Moore, when I read it, my recollection of his comments on the record came down to, gee, on the one hand, it seems like the thrust of OLR's argument goes back to the underlying offenses. On the other hand, it really seems to me like you're not getting it in terms of the expressions of remorse. It seemed to me that Judge Moore really struggled with that. And And we're most of us are very well acquainted with Judge Moore. He's a very smart man, very experienced judge. And it seemed to me that that's what he was really struggling with. Are you and I in accord on that, or do you see it differently?
Well, the case has a number of facets, and I agree that that's one of them. I frankly don't believe and certainly don't intend to hang OLR's hat on the apology issue or how heinous the conduct was back in 2008.
It's more subtle. It's more sophisticated than, like as Mr. Kao says, saying magic words. And Judge Moore is certainly more sophisticated than that. It seemed that he was trying to go deeper than that to try to sense if there was any real empathy with his victims in terms of looking for any signs on the record that he understood, that truly understood the damage he had done and truly empathized with the victims so that he wouldn't do it again. That's what, to me, that's what Judge Moore was trying to discern on the record.
I think that also this case is not about gambling. Mr. Schenecker has, on
no,
the record,
do you
taken
agree?
Admirable steps for that. But what I guess what I'd say with regard to that is that Mr. Schenecker did not adequately explain, as Justice Kelly asked, what triggered this, the non-gambling stuff. He did not tell the referee why he engaged in that behavior or what he would do to avoid
engaging. I wasn't just making an observation, Mr. Weigel. I'm seriously seeking your input. Do you agree or disagree with my assessment of what Judge... You're the one who just raised Judge Moore. And I'm telling you what I read in the record, and I'm asking you, if you don't want to share your insight, tell me, and I'll let you say whatever you want. But tell me your response to what I just said about what Judge Moore indicated.
I believe that Mr. Schenecker's fallacy of his presentation evidenced a lack of deep understanding for what he had done and what he needed to do. But what I believe, or what OLR thinks or suggests, is really neither here nor there. It's your referee and it's the court. And what referee Moore did say is he said, I described the conduct as selfish, as either illegal or immoral. And he wasn't hung up on the gambling addiction issue. He was troubled by what he described as his amorality in dealing with matters in truth and trust. And the referee then pointed out some examples. One was gambling, nothing to do with lying to a federal court. Rather, that speaks to the essence of this case, Justice Gableman, in the court. It speaks to Mr. Schenecker's moral character. And uncomfortable though some may be, myself included, in judging a person, in having a crystal ball that you believe is that unerringly accurate, it's really the case about Mr. Schenecker failing to meet his burden of proof, his affirmative burden of proof. His witnesses, not OLR's witnesses slinging mud at him, but his witnesses and his presentation, not giving referee Moore and not giving the OLR, and I would suggest not giving this court, the confidence that he is fit to act in matters of trust and confidence as a member of the legal profession, as representing the public.
Counsel, it strikes me that an attorney in this position faces the prospect of almost proving a negative, right? So he has been sanctioned in the past for behavior that violated our rules, and now we ask him to prove that he won't do that in the future. And so perhaps the best evidence of that is a life well lived. And he believes that that is what he has presented to the OLR. Is there anything in addition that the OLR and we should be looking for other than some demonstrated period of time in which he has conducted himself well?
Well, you look at the proof, and the referee said that the proofs that Mr. Schenecker submitted did not outweigh the evidence of record of that portion of his life that was not well-lived, that portion that reflected so very poorly on his moral character. You know, I don't want to unduly concentrate on OLR's witnesses, but I'd like to mention a few of them, and then, by way of answering your question, talk about Mr. Scheniker's witnesses.
Yeah, before you do that, perhaps we could address this in a conceptual manner first, and then we'll figure out, you know, how to hang the ornaments on that. What is the type of information that we should be looking for? And just so you see how I score this, he engages in conduct that is subject to sanction. We sanction him. That puts paid to that. Now we say, going forward, what is your conduct like? And what should we be looking for other than a life well lived? What positive piece of evidence should we find that would say, yes, and this shows us that he can be trusted with the practice of law in Wisconsin?
If I misunderstand the question, I apologize. I'm prone to that occasionally. But one way to perhaps I receive that question is, what more could he have done to gain OLR's confidence such that we would support his reinstatement? And I think there's several answers to that, Justice Kelly. The first, and I'm sorry, it probably sounds a bit snarky, after his first suspension, he could have conformed his conduct to the standards. To get to it, during the second suspension order, this court went out of its way to point out, we warned him in the earlier case to be reinstated. He has to conform his conduct to the standards. What was his response? He engaged in additional repeated acts of dishonesty.
And we sanctioned him for that. And now, so we've cleared the decks. Now what are we looking for?
All right. So it's not about apologies. You know, he could have presented a heartfelt apology to those persons and entities that he'd harmed prior to a hearing, rather than have his attorney do it for him to try to put words in his mouth. He could have called his therapist to testify, subjecting that person to cross-examination. He could have produced witnesses who knew his practice as a Wisconsin attorney and knew him now and were willing to come and testify for him and attest favorably to his moral character. He could have produced character witnesses who actually knew the details of his misconduct, of what he had done, if they're going to testify as to their opinion of his character. He could have addressed the referee's concern about why he engaged in this misconduct. And it does not appear from the record that he took those steps, and those are the kind of steps an attorney may take to gain OLR's confidence.
Counselor, I thought all of the misconduct was financial. Am I wrong?
Well, there's lying to the bankruptcy court. I mean, in some ways, everything you can track down to the money. There's a recitation.
And I also thought that it was alleged to be something that came about after he became addicted to gambling, but didn't occur before. Am I wrong about that?
The misconduct came about perhaps after he alleged that he became addicted to gambling.
And wasn't the gambling and the need to pay gambling debts and have money to continue to gamble the source of taking other people's funds?
I think that those decisions that he made about what to do in his life and to people were driven by more than what can be explained by the parameters, even of a serious addiction such as a gambling addiction.
Yeah, well, I don't really know much about a gambling addiction. But my concern is, if you're going to let someone turn their life around, and that's what he's asking us to let him do, and the OLR, you don't want him, the OLR, as who you represent, does not want him to have his license back. But if the court were to differ and to require him to attend biweekly meetings of Gamblers Anonymous and to continue in at least monthly counseling sessions, would that cause you to have less concern, or do you think this is totally His conduct is totally separate from we got the gambling under control, so he's going to be okay. I guess that's my concern.
I may see the world with rose-colored glasses. It seems he's got the gambling under control, you know, maybe always in recovery now. The concern was his moral character and the insufficiency of the evidence that he produced to convince the referee or the OLR of his moral character.
What is missing in his moral character right now that you're pointing your finger at? I see all the money he took from other people, and certainly his conduct is a long way from exemplary. And maybe I need to do more reading about addictions, and I guess I'm so taken with our opioid addiction in Wisconsin right now, I can understand that people get out of control. But I don't know what you're asking us to look at that he didn't do. I mean, some people are very effusive. They're warm and they're friendly. Other people are a little less so. It's just their nature. It's not that they're less sincere in their expressions of remorse or whatever it may be. I'm having a hard time figuring out what it is he should have done. What is it that he should have done that OLR would then be comfortable with saying, yes, we can readmit him?
I mentioned some of the things that I think he could have done to have gained OLR's confidence. And, you know, there are attorneys, and it happens fairly frequently, who petition for reinstatement. Their proofs are insufficient. The referee or the court does not have confidence that they should be again licensed to act in matters of trust. They don't quite cut the grade, and then they reassess, they put together better proof, if you will, come back and petition for reinstatement, and reinstatement is granted. This case is somewhat reminiscent of a guy named John Miller Carroll. The court looked at a matter that he had when he was petitioning for reinstatement, and he called like one character witness who knew him for 6 or 7 years and said, yeah, he's a good guy and he's fit to be a lawyer. But that was found to be insufficient, and one of the main deficiencies there was the witness really didn't know the details of what Miller Carroll had done. And I would suggest to you that in this case, you know, we have, again, the letters that OLR put in, by the way, not one of those is from a Wisconsin attorney recommending Mr. Scheneker's reinstatement. Mr. Scheneker put in two witnesses, in addition to himself, three witnesses. So Jason Vinloan, friends since kindergarten, you know, friends now. So he's called as a witness to attest to Mr. Scheneker's character, to help Mr. Scheneker meet his burden of proof. When he's asked about the conduct, he's like, I don't know, it's pretty bad stuff. It involves stealing money, maybe fraud. I don't know. It's bad stuff. We never really talked about details. He did not tell me he was criminally convicted. I was not aware he lied under oath in the bankruptcy proceedings. I never read the disciplinary proceedings against him. So how well does a character witness know some of the driving forces in his friend Mr. Scheneker's character? Didn't know about the gambling until 2017. There was the incident of the cancellation of the sporting event in the Pottawatomie Bingo. His other witness, and it speaks well of his father to show up for him, and it speaks well of Mr. Scheneker that his father would do so. It was his father, William Scheneker. Are you aware of the circumstances that led to the suspension? Answer, not really. It would be very vague. At the time, they had lived together for 4 years, and Mr. Scheneker, the elder, said, I never really noticed he had a gambling habit regarding his son's dishonesty. I guess it had something to do with some sort of theft. Again, I'm speculating. I don't know the details regarding his prior misconduct. I don't know that it involved theft of funds from his fiancée. I don't know it involved going into her bank records and getting into her accounts and taking money out of them. I didn't know it involved dishonesty with his former law firm. I had no idea why he's no longer associated with Game Master. I didn't know he had taken money from them and spent it at Pottawatomie. Did your son ever specifically say to you that he was sorry or remorseful for what he had done? And Mr. Scheneker, the elder, indicated no. And he's a character witness. And he's there, and it's a difficult family dynamic. But he said, who am I to judge? I don't know the circumstances. I don't know the particulars of it. So when asked by the referee, is there anything about your son that has changed in the last 8 years that will help me predict his conduct, that may shed light on predicting Mr. Scheniker's future conduct. You know, Mr. Scheniker's father really had no answer for that. OLR doesn't have a duty to produce testimony. Each of the people who testified, and I was not there. I did not try the case, but in a poignant and heartfelt matter, and that shines through in the transcript. Ms. Flanner is not just a scorned fiancé. She has a JD. She's a business person. She employs 10 people. What she said is, I'm scared for the public if he keeps his law license. He's an opportunist. Mr. Thompson from Clear Law Offices, I have concerns. He breaches the trust of the people he's closest to. Mr. Hagen still has an amicable relationship with him. Says he's very self-absorbed in the decisions he made. I said, well, you knew this guy lost his law license.
But
you knew he had a gambling
problem.
You're
quoting from, Mr. White.
Pardon me?
You're quoting from the victims of his previous conduct that he's been sanctioned for, right?
I'm quoting from the people who showed up at this reinstatement proceeding.
So the answer to my question is yes.
Sure.
Okay. Or sure. So it's unsurprising that the victims are going to have this opinion of him. It's our job, as Judge Moore pointed out in his written opinion, and this is why it's more difficult, it's more subtle and this is why I suppose we're here. You know, one could argue, this is Judge Moore, appendix page 21, which also happens to be page 21 of his opinion. One could argue at length about the relative weight to be given to the testimony of these witnesses, but there is one factor that resolves that debate without question, the burden of proof. Scheniker had the legal obligation to demonstrate by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence that he has the moral character to practice law in Wisconsin, that giving him a law license will not be detrimental to justice or subversive to the public interest, that his conduct since the suspension has been exemplary and above reproach, and that he can safely be recommended to the public as a person fit to be consulted by others and to represent them and otherwise act in matters of trust and confidence. And that gets to Justice Kelly's question is, and I don't remember your response to him, aren't we asking Mr. Scheniker to prove a negative, that aren't we asking him to put forward, but your response, as I recall it, was he could have put his counselor on the stand, he could have put attorneys from Wisconsin on the stand.
He could have presented people who knew him better and could testify more convincingly as to his fitness to be licensed and as to his moral character.
What deference is owed by this court to the referees, to Judge Moore's opinion?
Findings of fact would be in a clearly erroneous standard. Otherwise, it would be upheld. Otherwise, de novo.
Okay.
You make your decisions as to conclusions of law and as to sanction, result, and position of conditions. Guided by and aided by the referee's report and recommendation, but not bound by it. You know, Thomas Hagen is one of the witnesses who gave Mr. Scheniker another chance. He knew about the gambling. He knew about the loss of law license. He knew there was money issues. And he entered into this game master relationship, and he was asked, why would you do that? Why would you enter into a business relationship with him knowing these? He said, I've known him for a very long time. Giving him a second chance, not putting too much weight on things that happened in the past. It's kind of what Mr. Scheniker is now asking this court to do on the third go-round. Mr. Hagen got burned, and when asked about Mr. Scheniker, said, treating gambling doesn't change the core person. This was not solely the result of an addiction. This is a personal trait. This is a character flaw. Now, I'm not suggesting that OLR is adopting some kind of position that Mr. Scheniker should never be relicensed. Referee Moore certainly did not suggest that. Referee Moore, if I can find it in my notes, basically said he can come up again with better proof where he can truly show and meet his burden of proof that he has the character and should be trusted to act as a member of the Wisconsin Bar.
That would mean that he'd stay in the job, that he'd get good recommendations, et cetera. So it's a matter of time and additional showing that he's led a good life. Is that your point?
I think that's true. If I jump into Mr. Kao's shoes for a moment, I looked at the record and I thought, well, his boss gives him a credit card. That speaks well of him, and he's done well with that. I'm not sure for how long. And that person did not appear to testify and be subjected to cross-examination. But those are the kind of things, along with some of the kind of things I recited in the response to a question Justice Kelly had asked, that he might do to enhance the confidence. So as far as what has he done now?
He had a one-year suspension in April of 2016, so that would have ended April 2017. And we are almost into April 2018. So his suspension was for a year. Now he's got a second year, in effect, that he's being suspended. So how much more time do you want?
Well, he had petitioned, until he proves his fitness to the satisfaction of the court. He had petitioned in, I think, January of 2017, or when
right.
he was able to do so. These cases take, on average, 14 months to 15 months. When I say these cases, for the court study committee and one of the subcommittees I'm on, I did a study of the last 5 years' worth of reinstatement cases, and that's how long, on average, they take from the filing of the petition to the issuance of the court's decision. It is a long time, but we are not asking for an additional suspension. We're not asking for another pound of flesh. OLR very often supports reinstatement.
So what are you asking for?
That on the court find, on the basis of this record, that this petitioner did not meet his burden of proof, I'm asking that you have confidence in Referee Moore's findings and decision and judgment in determining that he has not sufficiently proved he should be fit to reinstate. We're asking you to deny this petition.
Right. So that means he's been suspended for 1 year, which that 1 year expired in April 2017. If the court denies this petition, and even if it does it within 2 weeks or 3 weeks, that's 2018. And that will have been denied. And then if he wants to come before the court again, he has to bring another petition, which won't be heard until the fall or spring or maybe winter of 2018, 2019. Is that right?
That's right. Or even later. I believe
or even
the court
later,
rule
right.
says that denial of reinstatement, a petitioner can then reinstate 9 months later. The court has, in certain cases, chosen to give different guidance despite that portion of the rule. In fact, for Mr. Carroll, I think they said, and you can file a petition for reinstatement anytime after 6 months from our decision here.
Yeah, because we didn't want a decision at one day and then a petition the following day, et cetera. So when do you think he'd get back if he petitioned quickly and the court put it on the calendar and got to it and then issued an order quickly rather than at the end of the term? When do you think we could issue that kind of order? What would be your timeline?
You know,
because I want to know how this one-year suspension works out to be a three-year or four-year suspension. It's already
well, there was a three-year suspension.
Years. Pardon me?
There was a three-year suspension, and then subsequently there was a one-year suspension that OLR thought perhaps could be tacked on to the end and imposed retroactively, and the court said no.
No.
Not with this
right.
response. We're imposing it prospectively.
This guy has a record.
Yes.
And progressive discipline is the rule in the court. Right?
It's the okay. court adheres to that concept, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So what's your timeline? What would be your suspected timeline that this could all occur?
If you issue a decision denying his petition
right.
for reinstatement based on the insufficient
right.
proof, he applies for reinstatement in 9 months.
Okay,
or
so we deny
you have a lesser
it.
Time.
Let's just say deny it in April 2018. Okay. So petitions when? May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December, January 2019, right?
Sure.
And then you get time to answer it and then filing briefs, and it would be heard maybe in the spring of 2019, right? Maybe.
It could be heard that early. In fact,
Carol's
second case kind of fast-tracked, and the reinstatement decision was made not too terribly long after the first reinstatement denial.
Okay, so spring of 2019 or fall of 2019, right? And if the court then issues a decision, it would be in the fall of 2019 or winter of 2019, and he will have been out, 3 years?
Sure, something like that. Excuse me for answering sure again. I handled a reinstatement proceeding on behalf of OLR for attorney Ted Mazza. He was out 20-some years on his revocation. We rather enthusiastically supported his reinstatement when he petitioned because he had the proofs and the guns. But
it'd be hard if he showed a good life for 20 years. A
suspension is not, a disciplined attorney can't just watch the calendar pages turn and say, oh, I've done my time. Time to let me back in. I'm entitled. I'm a law school graduate. The court puts, and rightfully so, a very high middle burden of proof on a petition.
Counsel, Mr. Harrison, the psychologist, said that the occasion for reoffending would be minimal if four things were done. And the first three I say I check off, and the fourth one I want to ask you about. The first one is if he continues with his treatment plan. Check. I think that's what he intends to do. Utilizes his support system. It may include the Gamblers Anonymous. Check. Continues to act and live responsibly, apparently. You could check that one off. The fourth is makes the changes that are necessary in his life. What are those changes that are necessary in his life? What was meant by that?
That's the point. He did not explain that in his presentation. He explained his gambling. He's been doing a great job on gambling. As far as the poor decision-making, I'm not so sure. As far as telling this therapist when he meets him about his strengths, loyalty, honesty, trustworthiness, you'll note that in that exhibit, which is Exhibit 10, at his first meeting, Mr. Schenecker also self-describes his weaknesses. Three weaknesses. Nice, trusting, and too honest. That's one of my weaknesses, he says. I'm too honest. And he's saying that 2 months after OLR filed Schenecker 2, the Game Master case. He's saying that while that case is proceeding. In fact, he said later, in February of 2016, there's a progress note in Exhibit 10, he's still waiting to hear from the court regarding reinstatement of his law license. That was on February 9th of 2016. He filed this petition in January of 2017. There are multiple indicia that Mr. Schenecker is not being fully forthright and fully honest in his life and in numerous aspects of it. And those give concern and gave Referee Moore concern, and I think resulted in the recommendation that you have before you.
Counselor, when and where did he graduate from law school? I see he was admitted in 2004, but I don't know where he graduated from and when that graduation occurred.
I don't recall the when. Maybe Mr. Kao can whisper to me, but the where was Columbia Law School.
Columbia.
Some of the people he went to law school with wrote favorably, and those letters were introduced by OLR and put into the record.
Thank you.
Is that Columbia University Law School?
Pardon me?
Columbia University Law School, or is it a different Columbia?
Columbia University, yeah, in 2002 or 3, I think. But
2003, according to the petition for reinstatement.
So it was an honor and pleasure to have the opportunity to discuss a case. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
May I?
Yes, please.
Well, make no mistake, they are asking for an additional suspension. And although I was told there would be no math, if this court denies reinstatement in a decision issued, say, May or June, he can't reapply until 2019. Mr. Weigel just said it takes 14 months. He certainly would be suspended no less than until the middle of 2021. I think that, and what I've understood, the absence of proper expressions of remorse, that sounds to me like a failure of advocacy, that his lawyer didn't get him to say the right things with the proper degree of earnestness. And I would suggest to you that
does it seem a little paradoxical that he's saying to his counselor that one of his deficiencies or one of his problems is he's too honest?
No. I mean, I think people are complex, and you've observed it yourself. We're neither all good nor bad, and, you know, it may be that it's self-serving or even aspirational to say, well, I'm too honest. I'm too giving of a person. I don't know what to make of that. But I will say that one of the expressions of taking responsibility and remorse is that he entered a stipulation. He pled guilty to his crimes. He entered a stipulation with the OLR saying, I'm guilty of wrongdoing. I'm deserving of a suspension of 1 year. And he honored that. The OLR has not. The OLR is second-guessing. It is reneging on its stipulation, in my opinion, and second-guessing this court by saying, we set a year, you set a year, it's not enough. It's not enough. Even though he's lived a blameless life during that interim, and we've investigated this for 6 months, we come up with no evidence of any wrongdoing.
But
a year isn't enough.
What's your response to Judge Moore's observation that I read to Mr. Weigel from page 21 about the failure of the burden of proof, which has nothing to do with a deficiency in advocacy?
Well, I mean, he did meet his burden of proof in every way possible. I mean, there's talk about the witnesses that he brought on live. In cases like this, a succession of character witnesses can be tedious. And if the OLR stipulates in evidence that's submitted on paper by a character reference, it foregoes its right to cross-examine and to criticize us for not exposing them to that when they've stipulated. They could easily have said, I won't stipulate in Mr. Harrison's report or the report of his employer or other character witnesses. I want to cross-examine. I want to know, you know, how much they knew. I want to be critical of the fact that they're not Wisconsin lawyers. They're out-of-state lawyers, which is a distinction I don't, frankly, appreciate, nor with the lawyers in Illinois.
Well, the theory is that if it's a lawyer in the same community in which he practices law, they would know him. And if he's in a community outside that, whether it's in Wisconsin or in Illinois, they won't know him.
Right. But what's relevant, I think, yes, I recognize that. But these are the people he knew. I mean, he came from out of state. He didn't practice in Wisconsin very long before losing his license. So his acquaintance with Wisconsin lawyers was limited. And I don't think any less deference should be paid to the opinions of a person out of state, presuming they knew him during this relevant period of time. And each of these witnesses did. And incidentally, it was asked what does he do in order to comply with the instructions of Mr. Harrison for changing his life. He indicated he should keep busy. He reengaged with his family. He spends time with his nephews. He established a chess club at the local school. He did volunteer work at his church, all of which I think wasn't part of a display in order to impress you that he's a good person, but to keep busy, as his counselor had suggested, so he doesn't yield to the temptations of the gambling addiction. So I think what he's done is much more important than what he might say. And what he's done is comply with all the terms of your suspension order and reapply at an appropriate time and ask you for a chance to reestablish himself as a useful person.
Do you have any objection if he were reinstated with conditions?
No, Justice Abramson. I would not. And I say that even as his lawyer, that it would be not so much a burden as a benefit for him to be made to observe the safeguards that would keep him out of the casino.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both very much. These are always difficult cases for the court, as I'm sure they are for counsel and for the parties involved. We are going to take a break now for lunch, and we'll be back for our third case at 1:30. Justice Rebecca Bradley will be down to chat with you all if you can remain a little bit. Thank you, and we are adjourned.